Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Tuesday, April 17, 2018. The time is 9:04 a.m. If you're joining us off net or online, we're in Juneau, Alaska, in the state capitol, room 532 on the fifth floor. I'm co-chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this morning, Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good morning, Madam.
Senator Stevens.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
We're running lean this morning. We are past the 90-day session where we would have all liked to be at home in our communities and with our families and constituents. Other members of our Finance Committee are actively in meetings, either under negotiation with the other body or presenting bills in other committees. So we should be joined shortly by Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Machicki, and Co-Chairman Hoffman. On today's agenda, we have two items, House Bill 38, Workers' Compensation, an act relating to the payment of workers' compensation in the case of permanent or partial impairment, and HB 400, Fees for Fire Prevention Measures. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing and hearing none, I'd like to direct committee members' attention to House Bill 38 and invite Representative Andy Josephson, as well as his staff, Megan Holland, staff to Representative Josephson to the microphones. Representative Josephson, if you could identify yourself for the record, affiliation district that you represent, and then please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'm very pleased and delighted that the committee seen fit to hear this bill. My name is Andy Josephson. I represent the UMed district in Anchorage. It's House District 17. And this bill, I'll try to be as succinct as I can be. Madam Chair, it's not unusual for members of the legislature to get concepts for legislation sometimes from random sources. And I remember when I was first elected, somebody wanted me to ban blue headlights, and I didn't feel particularly motivated by it, so I didn't file it. This was a bill that I suspect sometime around 2014, maybe even 2013, every member of the legislature received an email from a woman named Marianne Burke. And a year or two prior to 2013, her daughter died in an electrical accident in Midtown Anchorage. Her daughter was named Abigail Cottle. And Abigail, who was, I think, in her early 20s, could have even been 19, she was working to be essentially an electrical apprentice of some sort, although this was not, if it matters, it was not a union contract, so I may have the term wrong. But she died at the workplace. OSHA fined her employer, and what her surviving mother, who was going to testify, learned was that other than having what are called funeral expenses paid up to $10,000, there was no remedy for the family of any kind. And that's because Abigail had not married anyone and did not have any children or other dependents. That's what our system currently has happen in those circumstances. There are about 13 to 15 states in that range that have said a death benefit should be paid to single workers without children. And the highest, most generous state, based on research that is in basis and may be before the committee, is the state of Louisiana, which affords a $140,000 death benefit. There are some who have said that this is not a function of workers' compensation. It's really something in the insurance realm and that people should buy life insurance. However, these are deaths that occur at work. They're not heart attacks. They're not other unfortunate accidents. And they can often occur because of the negligence of the employer. Sometimes it's the negligence of the employee. As the chair and the committee knows, in workers' comp, we set those issues aside and we dispense with the issue of liability. So I've been working on this bill for 4 years. And in House Labor and Commerce, we originally had about $130,000 benefit. The chair, through consensus, reduced that to $70,000, and that's the benefit you see before you. Now, there may be members of the committee who have heard that this would expand workers' comp, which it technically does on the margins. But I think it's important to note that of the approximately, and it averages, unfortunately, about 20 people die at work in Alaska per year. That's sort of the range of people that unfortunately pass away. And what we see is that normally about three or four of them are single and childless workers. And so the sum total that would be benefited through that provision of the bill is about $210,000 typically, because it would be $70,000 times three. So it is not, in my opinion, hugely impactful. And a organization called the NCCI, which does reviews of legislation like this, a national organization, concluded that this part of the bill would only increase workers' comp 0.4% in the state of Alaska. Part of the you might wonder, well, how does it even get 0.4% if the total benefit's only $210,000? In reviewing the legislation, we found that there was a provision in law that had not changed since 1968, so 50 years, half a century ago, the legislature here in Juneau decided that if somebody died at work and they didn't have dependents as we might typically think of them, that is their own children, but they had, for example, a mother who was disabled in a wheelchair or someone that they traditionally could prove that was dependent on them for their daily maintenance, that they would qualify in the event of a worker's death for a payment of $20,000. So that's a figure that hasn't changed in 50 years. By inflation, it would exceed $100,000. But our bill says, let's call that contingent or that cohort $100,000. And then make the death benefit for a single childless person without dependents $70,000. So that there's some incremental rationale there. And to give the committee a sense of whether this is proportional, if someone relatively young were to die, say someone died who was 23, but they started their family young and they had three or four children, their widow and children would receive in the neighborhood of $850,000 in workers' comp payments over the span of the coming years. So you can see that where there aren't large families and lots of children, the drop-down is significant. And you can see that in that respect, it's quite proportional. So that's the first thing this bill does, is it creates a death benefit essentially for single childless people. And fortunately, there are only a few of those a year that that die. The second part of the bill is admittedly the more expensive part. What the second part of the bill does is update the permanent partial impairment figure for the whole body index, or maybe using the term slightly improperly. But essentially, currently, we use a figure of $177,000. And then when a doctor says, you've suffered the loss of an arm, which would be a 60% disability, you're going to get X dollars. Now, using the example of the loss of an arm, the injured person, that's a severe injury, obviously, would receive, in current law, about $100,000. Under the bill, they would receive closer to about $150,000. If we don't change the PPI and update the PPI, it means we're stuck in the year 2000 indefinitely. And while this has an expense associated with it, I think that it's important that we make this change. And part of the reason is, the data suggests that without the change, we are stuck in the range of, relative to our sister states, we are, for example, loss of an arm, 32nd, loss of a leg at the hip, 33rd, loss of one eye, 35th, loss of hearing of one ear, 33rd. Under the legislation, these numbers would put us in the 20s. We would be 26th for loss of a leg at the hip. We would be, for loss of an eye, 27th. So this isn't making Alaska the most generous place in the event of a severe disability, or any disability, permanent partial disability. It's putting us in the sort of average state range, whereas right now we are in the bottom third. So that's what the bill does. It just to repeat, it creates a death benefit for single childless people. It increases the death benefit for people who don't really have what we think of as typical dependents, that is children, but have these other sorts of dependents who've relied on them. And it increases the PPI, which hasn't changed in 18 years. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. And then my aide, Megan Holland, has a brief slide presentation.
Thank you for those comments, Representative Josephs. And I'd like to acknowledge that we've been joined by Co-Chairman Hoffman and Senator Von Imhoff. Thank you for joining us today. I did advise the public that you were on other state business when the meeting was starting. I'd also like to advise those that are following us off-net or online, the next document that we'll be taking in front of us is labeled HB 38, Workers' Compensation Benefits in the Case of Permanent Partial Impairment and Death. It's dated April 17th, 2018. It's prepared for the Senate Finance Committee, and it will be an overview that we'll have on our screen in just a moment. Are there questions from committee members on the goal of the bill, what the bill is trying to address? Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Josephson, as an attorney, you might be the appropriate person to ask about this. So I understand that that under current laws, you cannot sue for wrongful death.
That's right.
By opening this to $70,000 in death benefits, does that in any way put us in a position where the state could be sued more, open to lawsuits? Does that change that at all?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, no. There was discussion both in the House Finance Committee and on the House floor about opening up essentially Title IX, which is the civil lawsuit code, and allowing people who suffered grievous injuries through gross negligence to sue. But those were defeated, and I had a role in defeating them. And frankly, the business community would almost certainly, you really have my word on this, like that less. Because the result would be that people, although it could take years to achieve, they could receive millions of dollars in lawsuits. But no, this bill doesn't change that at all. It simply expands for a few people per year, literally, a death benefit that doesn't exist now. There are already death benefits for other people. And, you know, one thing I wanted to emphasize is, and Senator Stevens makes a good point or reminds me of something. Imagine losing a loved one at work who hadn't met their bride or their groom yet, hadn't born any children, hadn't had any children. They suffer a death at work. The death may not have been their fault to the degree the world cares about that, because in workers' comp we don't look at that. But there could be facts that they learn, and this is important, there could be facts that they learn that are inarguable, that the employer was at fault. And they go to an attorney and say, I'm devastated. My son or daughter has died tragically at work. I'm told I get funeral coverage and nothing more. And the attorney says, and they say, can I sue? No, the attorney says, this is an exclusive remedy. What exclusive remedy? Your funeral benefits. That's all you get. It is a devastating thing for a family to learn. And that's part of the bill.
Follow up, Senator Stevens?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, I'd like to direct members' attention to the presentation and ask Megan Holland to identify yourself for the record, Megan, and then start walking us through the presentation.
for the record, my name is Megan Holland. I'm staff to Representative Andy Josephson. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and members of the Senate Finance Committee for hearing this bill today. I'm going to briefly walk through a presentation that's essentially a sectional, but it's a little bit more fleshed out so that we can get into some more of the details of this legislation. Section one of the bill names this the Abigail Cottle Act in honor of Miss Abigail Cottle, who inspired the legislation. Section two of the bill is the portion that adjusts the whole person value for inflation, and this is the value that is used to calculate permanent partial impairment benefits. This increase is an increase of 44.35%. It's going up from $177,000 in current statute up to $255,506. This value was originally set at $135,000 in 1988. It was only adjusted once, and that was 18 years ago, as my as the sponsor previously mentioned, permanent partial impairment benefits are calculated by multiplying the person's percentage of disability by that whole person value. And percentage of disability is determined by the American Medical Association. So that's how those benefits are determined. Section 3 of the bill statutorily requires that this value be adjusted for inflation on an annual basis. The bill sponsor mentioned the reasons why we're increasing the permanent partial impairment index in his opening comments, but I would like to add that in your packets you should have a resolution from the Alaska AFL-CIO, and they unanimously passed a resolution in 2016 specifically asking the legislature to address this and to adjust this value for inflation. So I just want to add that, but he did cover the other points in this slide. Section 4 of the bill requires that in the case of a work-related death, the employer must notify the personal representative of the employee's estate of the compensation available, the statute of limitations for obtaining workers' compensation benefits, and where to obtain legal and grief counselors. This is already standard practice of the Division of Workers' Compensation, but it made sense to include this language in the bill, given that we're creating this new death benefit for individuals who don't have financially dependent immediate family members. Section 5, subsection 4 of the bill creates the death benefit for financially, or sorry, it adjusts, it increases the death benefit for financially dependent family members. In the case that someone dies at work and they have no surviving spouse or children, immediate family members are eligible for a financially dependent family members, are eligible for a death benefit of 42% of spendable weekly wages. Current statute caps this value at $20,000, and this is the value that has not been adjusted for inflation since 1968. As Representative Josephson previously mentioned, this increase is not an inflation adjustment. It's much less than an inflation adjustment would result in. Section 5, subsection 6 of the bill creates a new death benefit in the case that a deceased worker has no surviving spouse or children and has no financially dependent family members. This would be $70,000 payable in a lump sum to a surviving parent if there is one, $35,000 each if there are two surviving parents, or $70,000 divided equally amongst all legal parents if there are more than two. If there are no surviving parents, this lump sum would go to the estate of the deceased worker. And as Representative Josephson previously mentioned, this is sort of based off of what other states have done. There are 13 other states that have created a death benefit similar to this one, and they vary a lot, but there are several that follow this formula of giving the benefit to parents, and then if there are none, to the estate of the deceased. So in determining a solution to the problem presented by Abigail Cottle, there were sort of two foreseeable options. And one was to include this type of worker in death benefits, or to give them a death benefit, and one was to open it up to litigation. And as previously discussed, this was an issue that we delved into and determined that it was best to go with the death benefit as an option. In creating a death benefit of this kind, we provide a solution to the issue without undermining the system of workers' compensation. Whereas opening it up to litigation would fundamentally alter the system in place. Currently, you can already sue if there is an intent to harm involved. And I would like to note that there are no other states that allow litigation in workers' compensation cases with gross negligence. So if we were to go that route, we would be the first state. There's no precedent. And it's a lot more of a risk. The sponsor believed that it would be unfair to employers who already pay premiums for protections against the potential financial burden of a lawsuit. And in addition to that, benefits don't flow as seamlessly to dependent family members as they do now under the current system. Section 6 of the bill extends the eligibility for children of the deceased for death benefits to 5 years after the person is no longer considered a child. Currently, widows of the deceased receive death benefits for 12 years after their spouse has passed away, whereas children of the deceased receive death benefits until they are no longer considered a child. And that definition is until they reach the age of 19, until they finish school, or they're also still considered a child if they are wholly dependent upon that that deceased worker, either by disability, for example. So Section 6 of the bill extends the eligibility to 5 years after they are no longer considered a child. This could be a variety of ages because of the school factor that I mentioned. The reason why the sponsor included this portion of the bill was because of the fact that a child of the deceased may, under current statute, may receive death benefits for an incredibly short period of time. For example, if a child was 18 or 17 years old and their parent passed away due to a work-related injury, they would only receive benefits for maybe a year or so following the death, whereas the widow would for 12. Very briefly, I'd like to address the fiscal impacts of the bill, although we do have people here in the room that can do so much better than I can. There are essentially two separate portions of this bill with different fiscal impacts, and that's the permanent partial impairment increase and the fatal death benefits. The more expensive portion of the bill is the permanent partial impairment increase. If you look at your fiscal note, they were able to determine a projected increased payout in PPI benefits based off of a 10-year average that would amount to $512,850. This cost would be passed along via receipt authority to the Division of Risk Management, who would increase their payroll deductions accordingly in order to get the necessary funds to cover that cost. This does impact payouts to the second injury fund. Second injury fund fees are calculated as 6% of the total benefits paid in the previous fiscal year. Because this bill does increase PPI benefits, it subsequently results in an increase of second injury fund fees of approximately $30,000. I would like to note that this cost would decrease if the second injury fund were to be phased out.
And just if I could interrupt, it's Andy Josephson for the record. There's legislation before, I think it's House Bill 303 that would, it's House Bill 79. I should know that because I presented that on the floor, that would end the second injury fund. That's the reference to it being phased out.
Are committee members familiar with the second injury fund? Could you provide us a high overview of what the Second Injury Fund does?
I could try. Andy Josephson, for the record. Essentially what it does is it creates an incentive to hire previously injured workers. I think Ms. Marks is sitting in the room and could explain it better, but that's the essence of it.
Senator Bishop, do you have any comments that you could provide us on that fund? Some committee members were wanting to understand what it is.
I just recap what Representative Justin just said. He's accurate, but I'd bring the expert up to the table if this is the chair's prerogative.
We'll get there. I'll note that, Senator Bishop. Thank you. Please continue.
Through the co-chair, this is Megan Holland again, staff representative Josephson. As far as the fatal death benefits regarding, we're talking about the fiscal impacts here and we're on the fatal death benefits. The fiscal impact for these changes are fairly nominal. If you look at your fiscal note, you see there isn't really a value attached to them. And I spoke with the Division of Risk Management about the new death benefits specifically and how that would fiscally impact the state of Alaska. And because of the fact that these workplace deaths are so infrequent, and then on top of that, we're only considering workplace deaths in the case where a worker is unmarried, childless, and has no financially dependent family members, it occurs with such little frequency that the Division of Risk Management would most likely be able to absorb the costs associated with this new benefit without much fiscal impact. However, if there were to be a spike in this specific type of deaths, there could be it could look a little different than that. So I don't want to mislead members of the committee, but
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if this bill were to pass and all the provisions in it as in body types and increasing those payments as well as the death benefits for folks without dependents, how would that translate to increased rates that businesses would pay for workman's comp?
Through the co-chair, Senator Von Inhofe, I did ask the Division of Workers' Compensation to prepare a document that would show us how these costs would be passed along to the specific departments. So this cost of the increase to the PPI, first of all, we increase the receipt authority to the Division of Risk Management, and then they are going to increase their premiums of our departments in order to cover that increase. This is done based on the amount of personnel that they have, as well as how frequently they claim injuries. And I believe I turned in that document to members of the committee. It's from the Division of Risk Management, and it's an overview, a projection of how those costs would be passed along to specific departments. Just some quick highlights. There are particular departments that would carry a heftier burden in terms of covering that cost. For example, the Department of Health and Social Services would have to pay 19.9% of the projected total. DOC, DOT would carry more of that cost because they experience higher claims. As far as the entire state of Alaska, other businesses that are insured, this would increase the total costs of the system by approximately 2.3 to 2.8%.
Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I think looking at some research, Alaska's the fifth highest workman's comp premium state. We're at 145th above the median, and this will add more to a very high-cost system already, and I just workman's comp is already extraordinarily costly, particularly for small businesses, and it does affect how businesses can hire employees, pay employees. So I think it would be perhaps helpful with this bill to actually see what boots on the ground might cost. So find a business and a 2.8% increase, what does that translate into monthly payments?
If I could.
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff. Senator Representative Josephson.
Thank you. So there is Andy Josephson, through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff. The National Council on Compensation Insurance, the NCCI, prepared an analysis of this bill, and as my staffer indicated, Ms. Holland indicated, the increase would be 2.3% to 2.8% for the entire bill. Now, again, 0.4%, so only 0.4 of that, roughly 2.5%, is the increase in death benefits. The vast majority of that increase is in the permanent partial impairment update. And the problem is if we don't update that, we're already in the bottom third. So we're already in a situation where we're saying that the loss of a limb is set in the year 2000. And at some point, it's hurtful to workers who've already suffered an injury. So again, the loss of an arm, $100,000. No one would willingly take such money for loss of an arm. This updates it to $150,000. Now, I would note that we distributed on your desks is information about our improving status and the decrease overall in workers' compensation costs. It's something that Ms. Marks could talk to much better than I could. I would submit, I share your concern with workers' comp, but I would submit that part of our problem with it is that it's impacted by the high cost of medical care here for non-workers' comp injuries. So it gets lumped in with that to some degree. There is a belief, and there's some merit to it, and I've looked into this in some ways, at some length, that that workers' comp patients are they can be very lucrative patients for doctors. And so we had legislation a few years ago. There's a medical rate review committee that's looking at some of that. So there are independent efforts to rein in some of those expenses. But I would submit that this legislation has merit sort of beyond those considerations because, as I said, we're stuck in this 18-year lapse in increase in the PPI. And because the death benefit that we're wanting to add really impacts three families to the tune of $70,000 a family.
Senator Von Imhoff, followed by Senator Bishop.
Thank you. A death of a child is horrible. I'm definitely not demeaning that in any way, but I can't help but I represent small business, and I have to look at their viewpoint. And when we're having conversations about it's just a little bit of money, it's just a little bit of money to businesses, when we are fighting to keep a permanent fund dividend as high as possible, when just a little bit of less of a dividend could pay for all sorts of things here in the state. And so on one hand, we want to make sure that businesses pay their fair share. But on the other hand, we are trying to pay the highest dividend to people so they get their fair share. Whose fair share are we representing here?
Senator Bishop.
Madam Chair, with your permission, when the department comes up, I'd like to have a chart that breaks out the deaths by occupation, because Alaska is a unique state. We all know that. And I think you'd be surprised to see where these deaths are occurring and by what discipline they are occurring. I think it'd be helpful. Thank you.
Actually, Madam Chair, if I might.
Yeah. Senator Hoffman.
No.
Representative Josephson.
Oh, thank you. What I think the department will tell Senator Bishop is that for state employees, and one could surmise this would be true for private employees, for example, in DOTPUF, Department of Transportation Public Facilities, we see that workers' comp represent 31% of the total claims. And that sort of makes sense when you think about it. Health and social services is almost 20%. We've heard about people getting injured at API working with patients there. Corrections is almost 15%. And then public safety is 9%. That seems surprisingly low. After that, they're in the small numbers of percentages. So natural resources is next at 5%. So naturally, if someone works in an office, they're much safer. And so that's what I think the department will tell Senator Bishop.
Representative Josephson, I was trying to capture the numbers. What was the percentage for DHSS?
DHSS is 20%.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Madam Chair, I'm fully I appreciate that, but I wanted to go deeper and show what's lost in the aviation industry, oil and gas industry, et cetera, show the private sector as well, logging, et cetera. The department knows what I'm talking about. So
we'll have Ms. Marks up with the support of the committee. I'd like to get to public hearing, to public testimony. We do have multiple people that are waiting to testify online, and I'd like to respect their participation in the process. Is there any other questions for Representative Josephson? I had a couple.
Madam Co-Chair?
Ms. Holland.
Sorry, I forgot to mention an important detail in my presentation, and that was that the effective date failed to pass the House floor. In the original version of the bill, the effective date was January 1st, 2019. And given that the effective date failed to pass, if this legislation were to pass out of the legislature, it would become effective most likely much sooner than originally intended, thereby increasing the costs.
Ms. Holland, thank you for sharing that with us. I think we know the mechanics. Is there any interest in going through a section by section in front of us so that you can make notes along the section? Senator Stevens, you'd like us to do that?
Yes.
Okay. I have a question. Just let me get to it I tried to let you go all the way through. If a single person dies without a child, the bill before us proposes to divide a benefit of $70,000 between parents or two parents as a total. In today's world, there are many people, specifically someone that we might call a child, according to your definition, that are living with other folks or making their way with partners that are outside of that parent. In your bill, there's no consideration for that. The parent gets the benefit because there hasn't been a legal contract developed between the two parties that might be living together. Did you consider any of that particular conversation?
Madam Chair, relative to the question of partners, because people are free to marry whomever they want to now, that's sort of less of an issue. I think this is on topic. Governor Knowles had required that health care, for example, be afforded to same-sex partners. Now everyone can marry who they want to. So I think some of that argument would fall away. I don't think that's quite what you had in mind. But relative to that issue, I would say this. Under Title 13, which is the probate code, people can die, obviously, with debt. And those can be probated. Creditors can come to probate court and say, I'm owed for whatever. And that's an element that was taken up and is a factor in this. This will help the family pay those debts. But in the event that there isn't a parent surviving, the benefit would work its way through probate, and so siblings, for example, might get some of the benefit. We've also dealt with the situation to conform it to the Title 23 definition of what a parent or who a parent is, that in the event there's a step-parent, there would be sharing of that benefit as well, because it could be that somebody hadn't seen their parent at the time of their death for decades, and really they were raised by a step-parent, and so that issue is also made somewhat more equitable.
The variable, Representative Joseph, that I'm talking about is there could be an estrangement from parents where a child, a worker, doesn't associate with that parent, and your proposal creates their benefit over the right of a person that they may have chosen to pursue a life with. That's what I was asking about, not sure. Gender-based or otherwise, just someone in today's world that is living with someone else and has expenses together with that person. That person is not included in the proposal before us. The parent is, this is why I have a hard time with doing something for specifically one or two individuals, because all the variables aren't on the table for the ramifications of what is going on, that we are that we recognize and we cherish a loss, and that we try to change law to help deal with the loss, and there are unintended consequences for that. And so a couple things in this bill. We are naming another state statute after an individual who I'm sure is a beautiful person that deserves recognition, but we have tended to stay away from that in Alaska state law in naming individual pieces of legislation. So that's hard for me, because people are grieving right now, and there are other people who have walked in those same shoes before. And so we have multiple pieces of legislation that we'll hear this week that have naming in association with grief from a loss. And it makes it very difficult for the family members that are testifying. They're very emotional. They are very passionate about the loss of their child. And it makes it difficult to try to bring a frame to bear on the actual consequences of the legislation. And so I'm concerned that we're placing a family with expectations that Alaska state law will go forward and carry a particular person's name, and then are we being rational about the financial obligations of the state and the rollout impact on other parts of our state in the economy and otherwise? It's just very difficult for lawmakers to set those aside when we have a very compelling story in front of us about one Alaskan and the way that that person's life has been impacted. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You've been very indulgent with your time, so I'll just hit on a few points fast. First of all, the named portion of this in Section 1 would be uncodified. She brought the issue to me. I didn't have any exposure prior to hearing about the story to this type of event. So that's its genesis. Relative to the overall cost, I guess I would just emphasize that, again, it's three people per year, and it's three, four. We're not getting a lot of single childless people that die. This is not a very expensive feature, but very important, because otherwise there is no remedy. And so these people feel like there's nothing in the law that recognizes harm caused at the workplace. You mentioned, and then the PPI thing, as I've noted, I think needs updating. I think it's critical. And then you mentioned the whether it's appropriate to pay to parents where there could be estrangement, that sort of thing. Well, the difficulty with that is that could be true in an insurance case, too. You could have an insurance policy where there have been decades since it was created, there's been estrangement. So it's hard to have a perfect system in those circumstances. The other thing I would add is that other states do it this way, if that has value. Other states say, we're giving this to the parents if they've survived.
13 to 15, right?
13 yes.
Madam Co-Chair, may I very briefly address an issue
with these? We're back on the record. Ms. Holland.
Through the co-chair, I would like to briefly address what seems to be a little bit of confusion with the death benefit to the new death benefit to parents. So there's actually four different options. This is for the single childless worker with no financially dependent family members. One, if there's one surviving parent, they would receive a lump sum of $75,000. $70,000. If there were two, it would be $35,000 for each parent. If there were three or more legal parents, this would be equally divided amongst the parents. And four, if there were no surviving parents, this would go to the estate of the deceased. The third option of three or more surviving parents was actually added in when the concern arose that there could be other parents that were deeply involved in that individual's life that were being left out, which is why we included that third option. Additionally, I would like to note that this could be a fairly easy fix. In the state of Wisconsin, they have a similar death benefit, and they account for the estrangement of parents. In other words, their death benefit only applies to unestranged, non-dependent parents. So I'd just like to note that that might be a fairly simple fix through language change.
Ms. Holland, thank you for those additional comments. Where I was going is that I'm thinking of a death that happened to a family here in Juneau where a son lost his fiance. So they were engaged, ready to go, and this death was not work-related, but it should it have been. They were in a committed relationship, living together, getting ready to be married, and then if there were, then all benefits would go to parents, and if the parent and the family were at odds with each other, then there would be additional victimization for the son in this particular case, where the son may have all of the bills associated with the fiancé who died, and the parents would get the money, and then the person that was actually in the relationship and that were carrying the burden of the bills is not compensated. It's just bypassed to the parents. And so that was more, Representative Josephson, where I was getting to. That is not an instance that you're being brought up in the bill. It's just one that I'm taking multiple experiences over my lifetime to see that sometimes two people are surviving together and they have bills together, and the parents are not happy with the child's choice in partners or living situation or otherwise, and have estranged themselves, distanced themselves, or otherwise, and that family unit that they have created is carrying all of the bills. And so that's what I was asking about, is there's a relationship where the bills that you're talking about are carried by someone else, and that the parents may take the death benefit that you're proposing and leave the person that's actually carrying the expenses on the hook. And so what I was thinking about during your presentation on this benefit is whether there should be bills actually associated with that. That's what the benefit is based on, so that the money goes to pay for the bills that you're trying to deploy the resources to. And I'm not suggesting that as a change today. I'm just suggesting from life experiences that I have had over the course of the last 60 years, some of these family dynamics can create additional stress on the people that are involved. So it's not a reflection on what you've presented here today, just a journey that I've had where parents have been unhappy with two people's choices, and that sometimes they may not always behave after the child has entered into those other relationships and in a way that the person who passed away might wish. And so in respect for all involved in all kinds of different dynamics, I just put that on the record for consideration, because all families are not happy and all losses are individual and unique to that family's experience. If we could, other comments from committee members, I would like to move into public hearing. I will bring the department up. Those that have been waiting online may have been there since our beginning of our conversation, so I'd like to allow them an opportunity to express themselves about the bill in front of us. Representative Josephson, thank you. Ms. Holland, thank you for your presentation. the first person, I'd like to open the public hearing. I do know that we have invited testimony. I will open the public hearing on House Bill 38. It's an act relating to the payment of workers' compensation benefits in the case of permanent partial impairment relating to the payment of workers' compensation death benefits payable to a child of an employee where there is no surviving spouse, relating to payment of workers' compensation death benefits for an employee without a surviving spouse or child, and relating to notice of worker compensation death benefits. Public hearing is open. The first person to testify under invited testimony is Mary Ann Burke. She is the mother of Abigail Cald. Mary Ann, are you with us online?
Yes, I am.
Mary Ann, could you hold for a moment? We need to adjust the volume. Can you give us your full name?
Mary Ann Elizabeth Burke.
Mary Ann, we can hear you now. Thank you. Please proceed with your testimony.
Okay, I have a prepared little speech, and then I would like to respond to a couple of the comments that have been going on, and I have been here since 9 o'clock this morning. So, distinguished ladies and gentlemen of the Senate Finance Committee, I know that you have all probably heard from me in your emails and in person or through your staffers last week when I was in Juneau. Cost and time prevented me from coming today to speak before you in person. As you know, my daughter, Abigail Elizabeth Cottle, at a tender age of 28, was killed by being electrocuted as a first-year apprentice. The sad and unusual part of the story is that she was a newer apprentice who was electrocuted by the employer's gross negligence, rather than a journeyman being hurt by his own electrical mistake. Yet nothing happened to her employer whatsoever, and there was nothing given to her family for her life. How can this be in America, when freedom and justice are heralded as the greatest in the world? We have constitutional amendments, the Bill of Rights, that are to prevent this sort of accident, which says in continuation in Amendment 14, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Yet because the workers' comp no liability to the business owners, SB 323 from 2004, nothing happens to the gross negligent employer. So what is the legal remedy for my daughter's life? I'm a little angry right now because I'm getting no legal remedy from either way I go. This is what is so frustrating. How would any of you like to lose a daughter or a son through gross negligence and nothing is given for that person's life and nothing happens to them? That's the issue of justice regarding gross negligence that needs to be addressed by the legislature and Alaska Supreme Court at another time. I realize that because we can't solve all of this at once. But this bill, HB 38, does give some solace to those families who lose a loved one in the workplace by gross negligence or by accident. Also, so importantly, is the increase of the permanent partial impairment, or PPI, for those workers injured on the job. How can we ignore these people who have worked for years, who have families to take care of, who did not plan or want an accident to happen, who are our fellow brothers and sister Alaskans? I urge you today, at this moment in time, to please pass this bill for all of these very good reasons. By having some kind of remuneration for these death victims and these injured workers, we show that we value human life. We say this by the premium increase to the business employers. You must be more careful in the workplace, or more lives are lost and more injuries occur. The 70,000 that I wanted to address this, Ms. Senator Co-Chair McKinnon, the 70,000, in my opinion, is not going to go for bills when this happens to somebody else, for us, it would have gone to honor Abigail. And I think families that love the person that died, they want to set some kind of memorial for them. My sister-in-law did a chair in the park here in Midtown with Abigail's name on it. And we would have loved to do something like that with a little money, but we were given nothing, and we're just all getting through life ourselves. So to me, that's an honor of the person that is being killed, if that death benefit can please pass through the bill. In response to the lady with the small business representation, I have the comment that the businesses are not paying their fair share when someone is killed, like in my daughter's situation. They're not, and they need to. I mean, if you step back and look at this, there are many injured workers I've run into that are not even getting the minimum amount that they should be getting. So this is a real problem when you look at these injured workers that are not being taken care of, as well as the situation with our family in Abigail. Also addressed to the co-chair, Ms. McKinnon, when you mentioned non-parent, if I'm correct in what you were saying, non-parents are not emotionally hurting like the parents are. And I think it's fine if it goes to any guardian of, well, that may have to be discussed because it's an adult child in my situation. But the immediate family are the ones that are emotionally hurting that really are wanting some kind of value for their loved one. I think that's it. I'm sorry if in any way I'm offending anybody. I'm just pretty angry that I have had no due process whatsoever for my daughter's life. And I'm not understanding why in America that's not being protected, that my daughter's life should have been protected and someone like her should be protected. So maybe that has to be taken care of later, but I do hope this bill passes so that it at least gives some kind of solace to someone in my situation. And honestly, if you want to name the bill something else, that's fine with me. That's just what was posed to me in the beginning. But it doesn't bother me if the bill is named something else in honor of our loved ones that are killed in the workplace. Thank you so much.
Are there questions from committee members? Ms. Burke, I just wanted to say on behalf of the committee that I just want to extend our deepest regrets for the loss, for your loss.
Thank you. I don't see who said that because the visual is so about 10 seconds off from the audio. So who said that, please?
The Senator McKinnon.
Senator McKinnon?
Yes.
Is that who said it?
Yes, ma'am. It's the sentiment.
Okay.
It's the sentiment.
Yeah, the visual is just about 10 seconds off. It's hard to understand sometimes what's going on. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Marianne. Thank you for flying to Juneau. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 38? Mr. Doherty passed out a letter for your review, Kevin Doherty. From Eagle River. Mr. Doherty, would
you? Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Kevin Doherty, resident of Eagle River, and I've been general counsel with the Alaska Laborer since 1981. I fully ask your support for HB 38. Just for basic public policy, we need to pass this bill. And I'll address a couple issues that I think the committee brought up today. First issue is, I think we can say, thank God, the fatalities in Alaska have gone down. In the 1990s, we averaged about 41 fatalities a year, and we're down to about 22 at the moment, and we'll hope to improve on that. But there are no question there are fatalities that occur, and there's also major disabilities which are covered by the PPI, the permanent partial impairment. I think it is valuable that we did have Ms. Burke as a family testify today about her daughter, and I think as Representative Josephson pointed out, the name of the bill won't be codified. I don't think that was anything that even the family asked for. I think it was just an honorary thing. But we're a small enough state. I think we do care about people. It is worthwhile. In the years I've been here, I've seen and met with families of people killed on the job in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Puto Bay, Nome. We had a young man killed in Nome about 5 years ago in this very similar situation where they weren't married. So it occurs, and for those people to then find out that, when I said family, for the family to find out that we have a system that provides zero compensation for that death is adding insult to, I wish I could just say injury, but insult to death. So we need to address that, and I think there's an appreciation of that, I'm sure, with Senate Finance today. It is true Senate Finance has to look at the cost. I did, Madam Chair, I sent you away a document I think brought to you a week or two ago, but the Alaska Division of Insurance, I see Senator Von Imhoff looking at, that talks about the decrease. If you look at that, interestingly enough, 7.9% decrease, you know, has a lot to do with all kinds of people working on safety, employees, trade unions, employers, employer groups, all working together. So when we have a death or a disability, the groups that helped work pretty hard to push those rates of insurance from work comp down, I mean, at least deserve some respect for the fatality. I think the NCCI, National Council of Insurance, I've met with them over the years, a good group. They crunch the numbers. They come up here in October. They rated this bill at, I think it was 2.8. And we have a decrease that went into effect of 7.9. So again, we would pass this bill. We're not even going to, eat up more than, you know, less than half the decrease that we had. Fortunately, years before that, and there's another chart floating around, you know, we've had good years of decreases. We did have we had one increase in the past 10 years. The other ones have been decreases. There was a question, Madam Chair, you had about, what about in a, we have an unmarried couple and there's a death and there's a children where they haven't been married. That happens, we know. Well, fortunately, actually, if you look at the work comp cases since the statehood, if you are, man or woman, if you are the parent of a child, but regardless of whether or not there's ever been a marriage, as long as paternity is shown, work comp covers that child. So that part's covered. Also, interestingly enough, the Alaska probate law, has similar definitions of parents. Ensure we have occasional situations where people are estranged, but that's Alaska probate law. And for us to not do something because there are those exceptions, I think would be a mistake. That's all I do have. I know you had Jerry Falcone come through, a gentleman who got paralyzed on the job on the Whittier Tunnel project. I met with him. He came from Juneau a couple weeks ago and talk with you about the PPI and the need to finally get updated on that. So I'd love to answer any questions if you may have, and thank you for your time.
Are there questions from committee members? Mr. Doherty, thank you for calling in. Enjoy Eagle River.
Thank you much.
Is there anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 38? We had Don Etheridge from the Alaska State AFL-CIO. There is a letter of support in your packet. Just because of the length of the hearing today, Mr. Etheridge needed to leave. Anyone else wishing to testify? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. Ms. Holland, would you come back up? We were going to walk through a real quick sectional so that everyone is familiar. Are you able to do that today? And it can be high level. Just we like to know how the knobs turn section by section. I know you told us that in the presentation, but for us to devote the attention to the presentation, we're not looking at our document in front of us. And so some of us make notes on the documents. So if you could just give us a quick walkthrough of the mechanics of each section at a high level.
Sure. for the record, Megan Holland, staff to Representative Josephson. Section 1 of the bill provides that the act may be known as the Abigail-Caudill Act. Section 2 of the bill increases the base amount used for calculating compensation for permanent partial impairment benefits from $177,000 to $255,506. This is an adjustment for inflation. Section 3 of the bill provides that the director must annually increase this base amount for inflation. Section 4 of the bill adds a new section requiring that in the event that an injury causes death, the employer must notify the employee's personal representative of the compensation available, the statute of limitation, and where to obtain a list of legal counsel and grief counselors who may be able to assist. Section 5 of the bill does several things. One, it increases the maximum aggregate death benefit payable to financially dependent parents, grandchildren, brothers, or sisters of the deceased from $20,000 to $100,000. Two, it creates the new death benefit for deceased workers who have no surviving spouse, children, or financially dependent immediate family members. The amount of the death benefits available would be $70,000 payable in the lump sum to the parents if either is alive or to the estate if there are no surviving parents. Section 6 of the bill adds a new subsection providing that the death benefit payable to a child shall terminate 5 years after that person is no longer a child.
Ms. Holland, there is no retroactivity in this bill?
Through Madam Co-Chair, no, there is not.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Von Imhoff.
Madam Chair, I don't necessarily have a question about the sectional, but I just would like to see, have a question. We have Maria Marks or Scott Jordan in the room eventually.
Right, we're going to bring them up.
Okay, great, thank you.
Trying to finish the sectional. Mm-hmm. Ms. Holland, thank you.
Thank you.
If I could invite Marie Marks and Scott Jordan to the table. Ms. Marks is the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation, and Scott Jordan is the director of the Division of Risk Management. You can identify yourself for the record, and then we'll open it up for questions.
For the record, Marie Marks, director of the Division of Workers' Compensation.
And I'm Scott Jordan, director, Risk Management.
Welcome to Senate Finance. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question that I have is I would like to learn more about this grand bargain of workers' compensation, meaning families cannot sue for wrongful death, and that no other states at this time allows for litigation in workers' compensation cases for gross negligence. So essentially, I'd like to know what this grand bargain means and what it is. And essentially what you're telling me is that any company completely will get off scot-free if they have gross negligence resulting in a worker's death. I find that hard to believe, and I would like you to explain that, please.
Marks.
Yes, through the co-chair, Senator Von Imhoff. little history lesson. I think it's helpful to go back. So what happened during the Industrial Revolution is injuries started increasing drastically, severe injuries. And the injured workers would sue, and it would be an all-or-nothing result. They would either get a high reward or they get nothing. And on the employer side, they would be, if they're successful, be put out of business by very significant awards. So what states did, and all 50 states have this system in place, is they put in place a contract and said, okay, you're at your work day most of your day. To keep employers in business and keep them from being sued and put out of business and to provide benefits quickly to injured workers, here's the contract. Injured workers get quick, prompt, limited benefits to them. And it's limited because it's medical costs, lost wages, reemployment benefits if you're eligible, and death benefits in the case of a work-related death. That's it. There's no pain and suffering. There's no punitive damages. It's limited benefits. In exchange, they cannot sue their employer. And it's a no-fault system. So you don't look at what the employer may have done wrong, and you don't look at what the injured worker may have done wrong. And the system is set up to make sure when there's a work injury, benefits flow smoothly and quickly, these limited benefits, to the injured worker. And for most cases, this is how it works, and it works well. As you may recall, I testified previously, there's about 20,000 injuries that are reported each year, and in the vast majority of cases, those benefits flow to the injured worker. I think the concern in the previous testimony was correct in that no states allow you to sue for negligence. States do allow you to sue for intentional conduct. If you intentionally try to harm someone, states do allow suit for that. That will take you out of workers' compensation protection. But that negligence is what has been taken out of the system and replaced with this grand bargain.
Senator Von Imp, I'll follow up.
So in the case of the example of the testifier, a company, her daughter was electrocuted. I don't know the circumstances. In the event that the company doesn't change its policies to prevent something like that again and another worker dies based on the same set of circumstances, I don't know if it's gear, I don't know if it's process, if it's whatever it may be, what is this electrical company able to continue these unsafe practices to the detriment of the workers?
Through the co-chair, Senator Von Imhoff, there are consequences outside of workers' compensation that address an employer's standards of safety. And I would have to defer to labor standards and safety to address those types of consequences. So absolutely, there are things in place to incentivize employers to maintain safe work environments. Workers' compensation is a system of benefits, and it's set up only to make sure an injured worker, when they suffer a work-related injury, gets medical costs and their lost wages and doesn't put employers out of business. But there are separate mechanisms in place to address labor standards and safety issues.
Senator Bishop.
Just thank you, Madam Chair, for Senator Von Imhoff's concern. I know she's compassionate. I just wanted her to know that if it's a willful under the Department of Labor, that's a whole different can of worms. And then you can drop the hammer on a contractor or employer that's willfully negligent. And so that's as deep as I'll go. The division director could back me up on that. But
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So, yes, there are consequences outside of workers' compensation to address negligence. Yes, there are separate mechanisms in place to address this.
Through the co-chair, Senator Von Imhoff, that is correct, and I'm not the expert on what those are. But to my knowledge, there absolutely are things in place.
Okay. According to Ms. Burke, there wasn't another recourse for her under her particular set of circumstances. I don't know how gross negligence was determined and how it's being used here today because we don't have the underpin of the case that affected her daughter's loss of life. I just want to put that out there because we're working in the dark, knowing what underlies this particular case as far as the facts of the case. Other questions from committee members?
I have a question.
Senator Bishop, if you could pull your microphone a bit.
Ms. Marks, thank you, Madam Chair. What's considered a child and no longer a child? What's considered no longer a child under Section 6, 2330, 395(8)?
Through the co-chair, Senator Bishop, the definition of child is defined in the Workers' Compensation Act.
I can get that one, but what's the upper age limit, I guess? That's just cut to the chase, and let me say, what age are you no longer a child under the statute?
Ms. Marks.
Through the co-chair, Senator Bishop, it's unmarried dependent children receive benefits to age 19 or older while in high school or doing their first 4 years of trade school, technical school, or college. And then it could be longer as well if you are dependent, if you have a child with a disability and so forth. But the upper limit right now is essentially age 19 or during the time you're finishing school.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you.
Ms. Mark, so we're talking about extending that up to age 24 now, with the same caveats, basically.
Madam Co-Chair, and I'll just go ahead and look at the bill and make sure.
It says 5 years. Death benefit shall terminate 5 years after the person is no longer considered a child under 2330, 395(8).
Madam Co-Chair, that would be correct.
Senator Bishop.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would like to ask gentleman from Risk Management.
Scott.
Oh, Scott Jordan, right there. Mr. Jordan, we've had some discussion, and between the two of you, hopefully I can get some clarification on my answer, is we pretty much can see what it's going to cost the state of Alaska, right? Maybe $543,000 a year annually on the multipliers. But my question is, what do we think it will cost the private sector a year? Because I keep hearing that it's four hundredths of 2.5 or 2.6%. And I just want to know what that number would be out to the private sector, because I can't find it on any of these notes, ma'am.
Mr. Jordan, do you understand the question, and can you provide us an answer?
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair. Senator Bishop, I'm not sure where the math is coming from on that. The information that I provided is just the increase right for the state agencies. I don't know what it would be for the private sector as far as a percentage increase.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Jordan, it's not the percentage of increase we're trying to get to. We're trying to get to how it's going to adjust, I believe, the workers' compensation payment coming from the employer. Senator Bishop.
Yes, that's the number I'd like to see.
Ms. Mark.
Madam, through the co-chair, Senator Bishop, that amount, I believe, comes from that estimate from the National Council on Compensation Insurance. I think that was that 0.4%. They are an organization that prices out changes to workers' compensation systems. And what they have priced out is for the non-dependent, the new benefit for non-dependents, they've priced out that 0.4% increase. To give it some perspective, the overall amount of the whole bill, they priced out at 2.8%. And that's about $8 million total spread out of over all the state of Alaska, private, public, is about $8 million at 2.8%. So 0.4 would be a percentage of that. And I have to tell you, I don't do the math well in my head, but I'm sure.
So if we could get that,
Jordan may be able to.
We'd like to have the numbers so that we understand the impact. We do have one letter of opposition in our packet. If I could ask committee members to reach out to businesses in your community, and they are busy. They're trying to put people to work and keep their businesses going. And so sometimes we don't hear from those that are impacted on pieces of legislation, especially under a 24-hour rule and legislation moving very quickly right now. So I would just ask committee members to reach out into Kodiak, reach out into Anchorage, reach out into Fairbanks, and see if we can get some feedback so that we can bring this bill back before you for your consideration. Ms. Marks,
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, and so just maybe to clarify, the increase that is estimated in those base building block premiums would be 2.8% increase.
Ms. Marks, we understand. Yeah. We would like the dollar amount impact to the employer and how it's calculated. Am I?
Bishop. Here's where I'm going with my argument, because I like to build. I just want to show that it is pennies on the dollar per employee in the course of a 12-month period. That's all I want to show. So I just need the aggregate numbers from the private sector.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Senator Bishop, it is pennies on the dollar now, but if you look at it in Section 3, this provides an annual increase due to inflation. And by doing that, especially with compound interest, these pennies will turn into nickels and dimes and quarters and dollar bills in short order. So it's just something to be mindful of. And I think before we pass this through and have further discussion, I think a chart showing what typical businesses earning or having X amount of employees paying X amount in wages, showing a scale of as businesses, different size businesses, what they may be paying for this, not only this year, but maybe 5 years from now as this inflation begins to compound and kick in. I think that's where the dollar amount really becomes impactful. And that's when businesses make decisions about dropping one employee in order to pay for the workman's comp for the existing employees in year five. That's when it becomes material. So the things that we do now, while they have wonderful benefits, there are consequences, as Senator McKinnon discussed earlier, that we just need to know what they are before we move forward.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Isn't it true that it isn't only the businesses that pay that workman's comp, but there's a portion that the employee pays as well?
Yes, Mark.
Through the co-chair, Senator Hoffman, no, employees do not pay into workers' compensation. Workers' compensation is paid for by self-insured employers and insurers to the injured worker.
There is another tax that was before us recently that had an employee contribution. I'm not recalling what it was, but Senator Hoffman, I'm recalling the same information. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure who to direct this question to, and I'm not calling the sponsor of the bill into question, but I find it hard to believe. And is it really true that that the sponsor is correct, that there are no dollars recoverable to the family of the deceased if the person is single and childless? Is that really true?
Mr. Jordan.
Through the chair, if I'm understanding your question correctly, if there is a death of an employee without any dependents, excuse me, or anybody dependent on them, then the only benefit they would get is the $10,000 funeral expense benefit.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
I guess in this day and time, I kind of find that hard to understand or hard to believe that that is indeed the case, and that the state either hasn't kept up with or hasn't, or the risk-benefit portion of it hasn't done something to correct this. And what's the thinking behind it, I guess, is my real question.
Well, through the chair, Senator Olson, I can't answer that because that's a work comp question as to how these statutes came about and the reason why. But I think the thing to take away from this is that workers' comp is there to compensate an employee for an injury or, in the case of a death, to compensate their dependents. And when there is no dependents, there's nobody there to compensate to. So
no further questions, Madam Chair.
Senator Bishop.
I'd just like to say, I got a story I'd like to share.
Certainly, Senator Bishop.
And I get it. I got it. But, and this is just my story. none of us get up in the morning going to work wishing not to come home at the end of the day. You know, I was severely injured in 1975, and if it hadn't been for a former lawmaker that worked in this building that took the radio call, I might not be here today.
Senator Bishop, thank you for sharing that story. We absolutely know that workers' comp is a balance between the employee and the employer with severe consequences to families that are suffering great losses and employers who are trying to provide employees opportunities to work. And Senator Olson, I know that you know this, but I'll just say it for those Alaskans that are following this important issue and the proposal that's before us. Because that balance is out of control when it reaches a floor of either the House or the Senate, I think there is reluctance to advance legislation because anyone can offer an amendment on the floor and the conversation can go any particular direction, and I think that you know, that is the American way, that to have arguments and take them and talk about them and let the majority rule, per se. In workers' compensation, what I've seen over my 12 years of service is people trying to come together on one issue and changing that issue if everyone can agree on that issue, and that's what's difficult about the proposal before us today, and quite frankly, what was difficult about the other workman's comp bill that we heard earlier this week that we're trying to digest and understand the consequences on. And so as we consider those pieces of legislation that involve employees and employers and looking at that fair balance, I hope everyone will try to come together on things that we agree with, and if we can set aside those that we don't agree with, we might be able to advance change. But if we're going to fight about the things that we disagree with, then I'm afraid that it will stall all legislation around the issues that are important to the people who are out there working in Alaska that expect fair compensation for injuries. 18 years this hasn't been changed. There's a reason it hasn't gone forward. And I just ask for your help in trying to draw together for solutions versus finding points or reasons that we don't do anything. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Understanding that it hasn't been addressed for 18 years, what have other states done in regard to including inflation in their workman comp benefits? Do we know what other states are doing in that regard?
Ms. Marks, do you have any historical information that you could provide the committee?
Madam Co-Chair, I do not know what other states' statutes provide as far as inflation, but I'd be happy to get that information if the committee wishes.
We do have a document in our packet from Legislative Research. I have not previewed it as of yet. It may have some research information on it, as well as Ms. Holland might be able to provide us additional information to distribute if she can take a look to see if other states actively change their workers' comp or if there is a reluctance to change the balances that are created. We heard about the Grand Compromise. For those that had to accept that, that might be a difficult pill to swallow if they've lost a family member. The fiscal note, because the effective date did not pass, is inaccurate, so I'm going to set aside the fiscal note for today. We need to decide what can be done, if anything, or just recrafting a fiscal note so it accurately reflects, which creates a barrier, Ms. Holland, just so that you know, it creates a barrier to advance if there's no time for implementation on some of this. But we'll take it and start working on the issues that have been brought up in committee today. With that, we will work on a new fiscal note that would reflect the lack of an effect, the lack of not passing an effective date. I'd like to hold this bill. Amendments are due by tomorrow at 5. If you have any concerns with the piece of legislation before us, please let me know sooner rather than later. If we get amendments or concerns earlier, we can work with legal during business hours versus taxing groups to work into the night after a long 90-day session. I would just say that I'll put on the record that I probably do not support the inflation-proofing concept for the reason that has been discussed by other members at the Finance Committee table. Those pennies do turn into nickels, dollars, and I'm guessing that's one reason that we haven't addressed this for 18 years is the same issues continue to arise where we're wanting to inflation-proof and let it go. So, again, I think it's Senator Bishop or Senator Hoffman that have said don't let the perfect get in the way of the possible. So if there's a way, again, to create fairness in the bill that's before us in a way that's acceptable to members, please notify my office as soon as possible. With that, I'd like to set this bill aside. Thank you, Ms. Marks, Mr. Jordan, Ms. Holland. The next item before us for a brief introduction, considering we have a floor session that begins at 11 o'clock, I'd like to direct members' attention to HB 400, Fees for Fire Prevention Measures. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. The next item before us is House Bill 400. It's an act relating to the collection of fees by the Department of Public Safety for fire and explosion prevention and safety services. This is the first time the Senate Finance Committee is seeing this bill. It's brought to us by Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins. He has been called to the floor. He has been waiting for the entire time trying to speak to the Finance Committee. Please extend our apologies. There was an important conversation happening before us. Kathy, if you could say your name so that I don't mispronounce it, I'd appreciate that. And then if both of you at the table would identify yourself first and then tell us the problem and what this bill is trying to solve.
For the record, this is Kathy Schlingheit, Staff to Representative Chris Tompkins, and thank you for letting us present today.
For the record, my name is David Tyler. I'm the Alaska State Fire Marshal.
Ms. Schlinai?
Yes, ma'am.
If you could give us some opening comments of what is trying to happen here.
Yes, HB 400 arose out of a statutory recommendation from the House Department of Public Safety Finance Subcommittee and was introduced as a House State Affairs Committee bill. It's trying to address concerns in the Division of Fire and Life Safety in terms of building inspections. The goal of the division, as Chief Tyler can speak about, is to inspect all buildings every 2 years, but buildings off the road system are being inspected every 3, 4, 5 years because there's not sufficient money for travel. And this bill would allow the Division of Fire and Life Safety to collect fees for the spectrum of services that they provide to help fund that travel. So right now, they can collect fees for building plan checks, but not for actual building inspections or for permitting for installation of fire suppression systems or fire extinguishers. It's a very brief bill. As you see, Section 1 gives them the authority to collect these fees, and Section 2 sets up the receipt authority to receive the money.
Ms.
Schlingheit, ma'am.
I was trying to write down as quickly as I could your comments. Every year we're trying to inspect, or every 2 years for all buildings?
Right now the goal is every 2 years. Every year would, of course, be ideal, but the goal right now is every 2 years.
And when we inspect, do you know whether we create an exception list or a list of things that need to be done on a building so that I think 2 years is excessive. So a building should be solid. So I'm not understanding. Now it's fire that we're looking for this particular one, I believe, but building inspections every 2 years could be burdensome to those that operate the building. So help me understand why we do 2 years and how we hold people accountable when we actually inspect.
May I direct that question to the Chief Tyler?
Certainly. Mr. Tyler, if you'd put yourself on the record and then please provide comments for committee members.
Yes, my name is David Tyler. I'm Alaska State Fire Marshal. Madam Chair, there is some accountability for this, but not to the degree that for these fire inspections, but not to the degree that we would like. When we go into an occupancy or a building at this point, we give them a notice to correct for any deficiencies that there may be in a timeline that they need to do that. There's not much we can do beyond that other than a misdemeanor charge or eventually to close the building down. There's nothing really in the middle there. That's something else we're working on for another day. But we do hold them accountable. The problem is we can't get back out to do the second inspections, you know, or the first inspections, much less the second inspections. We're looking at ways to try and find more efficient ways to verify that some of this work has been done without having to physically go back out. But it's our goal right now is 1,500 inspections a year. We have roughly 3,000 buildings that we're responsible for. We're pushing real hard. I think we might be able to get 500 done this year because of travel restrictions. In some cases, some of these buildings have gone 6, 7, 8 years without being seen because of the remoteness.
Could you give me the name of notice of compliance? Is that what?
It's a notice to correct. Order to correct, yes, ma'am.
Notice to correct. Questions from committee members? Senator Bishop, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Mr. Tyler, I'm just going to go with the common sense and observation. Wouldn't you think the insurance industry would be getting a little concerned if some of these inspections aren't being done in a timely manner? And if, God forbid, if there was an incident, I don't know what your policy looked like, but was it annually inspected for X, Y, and Z, life, safety, and health, and fire? And I would think the insurance industry would be having some questions about why we're not doing our job.
Mr. Tyler.
Madam Chair, through the Chair, Senator Bishop, I agree. I wish they would, too.
Thank you.
I wish there was more interest there.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You say that many facilities in rural Alaska don't receive inspections maybe 3 or 5 years out. Why is that happening? Wouldn't the department have a rotating schedule so that they would hit those areas, say, in one part of the state and take care of them because of the increased costs and do that in other areas of the state? It seems as though to provide some sort of equity that the department would have a rotating schedule to have them addressed so that particularly maybe not as frequent as those on the road system, but at least those that are off the road system are treated as equitably as possible on a rotating schedule basis and concentrate around the state on a cycle of maybe 3 years to get that accomplished. It seems as though to have that disparity, that should have been addressed already.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, it has been addressed. If I may give a little bit of history.
Please.
Between 2001 and 2007, roughly, we had over $50 million worth of loss in public schools. And when I came on as a fire marshal, I saw the need there that we just weren't getting out to these areas. And as I talked to Senator Olson earlier, that included the Hooper Bay fire, which was preventable. It was started by kids playing underneath the school. If we had been out there, we'd have seen that the fencing, the underside of the building wasn't secured, and we'd have seen that that was fixed. And it's those type of things that we're looking for. But that's $50 million worth of loss to public schools, and I believe it's involved 76 fires. In 2008, we got an increment to help with our travel. We had full staffing. Over the next 5 years, we had $1.4 million worth of loss. And then after that, we started having staffing issues, you know, trying to fill vacancies. There was the travel cuts, travel restrictions, things of that nature. And we're back up right now to over $2 million a year in fire loss. So, and that's why I'm back now, trying to get some funding so we can get back up on step. We were getting close to 1,400 inspections done a year in our prime, and the numbers show that it was working.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Fire obviously is a very serious matter, especially in rural Alaska, where you do not have adequate firefighting capability or as well as a fire department to go ahead and deal with that. You've already touched on some of the financial losses that have gone on with public facilities throughout the state of Alaska, and Hoover Bay is in my district when half the town burnt down because of the close proximity of many of the houses that were there. But even more devastating was this fire last December that happened there in Nome when the Polaris Hotel burned down and somebody that I know was lost in that fire. How could you have prevented something like that that's so devastating to this mother that died in that fire?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, what we could have done is done more a follow-up inspection. We knew, I believe it was 2016, that this fire alarm in this hotel was not functioning. I don't have the exact dates for that, but so we issued immediate order to correct, and we were assured that this had been corrected by the owners, and this was not the case. I can't go into real detail on this right now because this report is complete, but it's sitting at the Office of Special Prosecution right now because we are pursuing it.
Madam Chair, just a comment. I think that the concern that the fire marshal has brought up is very concerning. We all know that I tried to put an amendment through here when the operating budget was coming through because of these fire issues, that especially with rural Alaska, it was unfortunately defeated, and I think that we are obligated to go ahead and look at the possibility of trying to increase the amount of money that we have for inspection to curtail some of the loss of life as well as some of these public facilities that we have to pay for in the long run, and especially those of us here at the Finance Committee for these, whether they're schools or whether there are other public facilities that are out there that we own.
Thank you, Senator Olson. The bells are ringing. If I could, I'd like to open the public hearing. You can remain seated. I'd like to open the public hearing on House Bill number 400, an act relating to collection of fees by the Department of Public Safety for fire and explosion prevention and safety services. Is there anyone on net, online, or here in Juneau wishing to testify on House Bill 400? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. Senator Bishop, could you cover the fiscal note for us?
Sure. I have one question for Mr. Tyler real quick.
Certainly, we're not done.
Mr. Tyler, is there any independent third parties that do the same inspections that you do that would be signed, sealed, delivered, blessed by your office, you know, that do it for a profit?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, there are companies out there that go do the actual inspections and maintenance work on the systems, fire alarm systems, the suppression systems, and that. And that's part of what we do. Since we permit and license those individuals to do it, we're checking their work as well as the rest of the building as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Tyler. Senator Hoffman.
In a follow-up, in the instance of Nome, would it have been possible to use the fire chief in Nome to verify that the work was done, or what prevents that from happening?
Mr. Tyler.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, there's some process that we are working on to do just that. In fact, there's another process that we're looking at including in our regulation adoption this year, that will allow us to use an outside company that would work with the vendors that do like the fire inspection for the fire alarms and for the suppression systems. Right now we get those reports back on like second generation carbon copies, so it's really hard to read what they're doing. But this new system that we hope to have in place next year, we'll get this stuff immediately through this company at no charge to the state, no charge to the local communities that are doing this. And we'll have an immediate information on our computers showing us who's compliant, who's out of compliance with their inspections, and we'll be able to respond accordingly.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Machiki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A quick one, Marshall Tyler. Can you, in your spare time, can you provide us, just so folks have an understanding of the role of local fire marshals, state fire marshal, insurance-related inspections, and gaps that you see in the system? I think it's a longer discussion than we're going to have today. I think there are some gaps in the state, but I think if you can help all of us understand how the various systems work, I think that would be very helpful.
Marshall Tyler, can you provide that to the committee?
Through the chair, Senator Machiki, we have some real good stuff going right now. We have a deferral program for when communities have reached the point where they can do these by themselves, these inspections, these fire investigations. We give them through a process, we give them our authority to do that. I believe we have 14 right now, Ketchikan, Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, the UAF, and that helps us a lot. And I'm a firm believer that local government can do this much better than the state can, and we can do it much better than the feds can. So, as we can push this down, I really try hard to do it. City of North Pole, City of Cordova, those are some ones I'm working on right now to try to get them to start doing this. So the more of that we can get, the better it's going to be for, I think everybody all along. We go through and we do an audit every couple of years on that. We have an annual fire and building officials forum where we meet annually. We've been doing that for 11 years now with fire and building officials across the state to discuss common issues. And we also use that as part of our code development process so that we're all in the same boat. And we're in constant contact with each other. We respond, for serious fire investigations all across the state. It doesn't matter if an area is deferred or not. We help them out with that. But any holes, I think, is the travel. That's what's hurting us the most is getting into these harder to reach. We hit the low-hanging fruit. That doesn't cost us anything to drive up the road.
Mr. Tyler, we'll have to set aside the fiscal note. We need to get to the floor session. So we will not be covering the fiscal note. Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it's, of course, pretty shocking to hear $50,000 in losses in public schools in 2001. Now we're at $2 million this year. I guess my concern is, well, first, if we raise fees, collect fees, we're only charging ourselves. We're the ones who will be paying for that as the owners of the public schools are as the only primary payer of education in Alaska. Is there any prioritization that occurs to public schools compared to other structures?
Mr. Tyler. To the Chair, Senator Stevens. We go out there with our primary objectives to hit the public schools because we got to keep the kids safe, and that's a huge investment for the state. But while we're there, we hit other higher risk occupancies as we can, ones that daycares where we can, some cases churches, just where people are gathering. Community centers. We just lost a community center here recently. I don't know what the cause of that one is yet, but it's we go where we have the most problem, where we can get the most bang for our buck.
Thank you.
Mr. Tyler, do you, as the fire marshal, provide notice that you're going into the buildings before you arrive?
Yes, Madam Chair, we do. We have a pre-inspection form that we send out ahead of time so that they can look at it. Our goal is compliance, not enforcement.
Thank you. And the only concern I have with the bill before us is that the department is left to itself to set the fees. And as Senator Stephen points out, we're charging ourselves. And so, anyway, we'll take a look at that. The other thing is that we I would ask the Department of Administration to go back over and provide a fiscal note that reflects the revenue as it should. It's estimated, based on the backup documents, of $84,000 worth of new revenue. And so I'd like to see that on the front of the fiscal note, so that it's incorporated into the budget appropriately. With that, I'd like to set this bill aside. Thank you for presenting HB 400.
Thank you.
Is there anything else to come before the committee? Seeing and hearing none, on this afternoon's agenda, we have SB 76, Alcohol Beverage Control Board. We're adjourned.